We welcome Dilipa Fonseca, who's senior correspondent for Business Desk. That's businessdesk.co.nz. You can also find it on the Herald. Good morning, Dilipa.
Kia ora, Catherine. How are you going?
Goodness, I'm really glad you're doing this subject. The immigration numbers are just out there, aren't they? The net inflow is at record levels at the same time as we seem to have a net outflow of Kiwis. A gross outflow of Kiwis. Overseas. Some of this is understandable. It's delayed travel, or rather delayed OEs if they're going away for a period of time. But you've been delving into the whole impact on our labour force, Dilipa. Can you explain?
Yeah, so it's really interesting with these immigration numbers because, you know, like you say, they are quite high. I think the latest figure was something over 130,000 net inflow over a year. Of course, like you kind of alluded to, immigration, sometimes with these numbers, it kind of depends over what time period you look at them over. You know, if you take the whole COVID period into account, it sort of averages out. It's still quite high relative to other OECD countries, but it's not necessarily out of step with some of the high levels of immigration we've seen in the past. But I think what was really interesting to me was there were if you look at some of the, now this is what we'd looked in our article around, if you look at some of the numbers in terms of the people who are on the accredited employer work visas who are coming in and the kind of skill levels that they're at. Now, these skills are levels that's it's called an ANSCO classification system. It's not perfect. You know, some things that we would consider quite skilled are sort of ranked as low skilled in the system, but it's kind of a rough proxy. And what was really interesting is that even though the net migration numbers have gone up and that's been driven by a very large inflow of people, the actual number of really the highest skilled workers, which is they've actually gone down both as a kind of proportion of the numbers, but also as just, you know, in absolute terms, which was actually a little bit surprising to me. But it does reflect that, you know, the immigration story is a little bit complicated now. And in some ways, what both sides are saying is true in the sense that, you know, some people are saying the numbers are too high and that's, you know, historically high. But then you still have listened now, but you still have complaints about difficulty of getting skilled workers in. If you talk about those really skilled professions like, you know, the healthcare industry and things like that, they're still facing shortages. And actually, I guess these numbers would sort of show that both stories are true. For the highest skilled people, there's still issues getting them in.
Okay, could you be a bit more specific about some of the particular areas where we know there's a shortage and we're struggling to get what we need?
Yeah, so, I mean, those ANSCO kind of skill levels, like, you know, some of the highest skill categories, they're things like your nurses and that sort of thing is a big, long list. This classification system goes down into very specific, skill categories, you know, like right down to, you know, nursing support workers and drillers. And they're all kind of, they're all sort of put into this different classification system. So the skill, you know, the numbers don't necessarily show that, don't necessarily indicate like to what extent there's a shortage happening, but it is very interesting that, despite the rise in numbers, you're still getting, despite the rise in overall immigration numbers, you're still getting, you're getting a reduction in the number of the most highly skilled professions. But some of the things that you might think are very skilled, like some of the trade professions, they're in this classification system, they are ranked as in the lower skill kind of, at the lower skill levels, but people in those industries would still complain that there aren't enough of them.
It's interesting also, because we're going to get to another visa story in the moment, in a bit more detail in terms of what's going on there. But what you're saying in your article is what the immigration advisors have been saying, and the other data is backing it up, which is that a lot of this is temporary visas, right? Temporary visa holders. We're not talking about people on a pathway to residency.
Yeah, so this is the interesting thing, because I guess we had a big debate about an immigration reset, and I think it was later called a rebalance away from temporary migration. But these numbers would seem to indicate the opposite has happened. That and because now you know, we used to have a kind of skill a point system for people to kind of apply for a migration pathway. Now we have these green lists, and there is a kind of point system, but it's sort of altered to be more limited. And so because of that, we actually have much more limited pathways to residency, and only for specific provisions. So a lot of the migrants at these particular skill levels don't actually have a pathway to residency, and they're the numbers that have been growing.
One of the issues with having this sudden surge, and as we said, it's in some ways it's evening out the 2 years, better part of 3 years, that there was hardly any, right? There were times with movements. But the problem is the focus always comes on where are people going to live, right? And that relates to another story, which is just how slow we seem to be at keeping up with infrastructure. So, you know, with this focus of are we getting the workers where the need is, and are we getting the high-skill workers, which is the way the system is often tilted in order to prioritise high-skilled or high-in-demand workers, or not? I'm interested in what the new immigration minister is saying about some of this, and what her intentions are. Has she? I know she's made some statements, but has she got specific at all? Dilipa.
Well, yeah, she has. She obviously did raise a lot of concerns, quite high profile concerns in the lead up. And she has said that she is doing a deeper review of the whole system. And she does want to see changes to the credit employer work visa. There are, you know, obviously some voices who are saying that that's not enough, because at the same time, she seems to be indicating that she doesn't necessarily want to completely rearrange how that accredited employer work visa works. She thinks the immigration department has been through enough change already. And also, as I think she indicated, even with her changes that she announced recently, those still have to be done with manual workarounds because it takes a while to update the computer systems the way that they're set up. So she's indicating there that there are, you know, making any change in the system, there are issues with doing it. But there are obviously voices on the other side saying, hey, you raised these concerns. And funnily enough, one of those is actually the previous now Labour immigration spokesperson Phil Twyford, and they've sort of seemed to be indicating it's not official policy yet, but they seem to be indicating a bit of turnaround on.
Well, let's get into that. Let's get into that, because we've seen all these high profile issues with the visas. It dates back to the whole plea that was coming during the pandemic from companies to say, look, I've got a restaurant here and a restaurant 200 metres down the road, and I can't move a worker from one to the other. More latterly, what we're seeing, particularly with this high number coming through right now, are you know, want-to-be migrants being completely ripped off, getting here, they're finding out they haven't got the jobs or conditions they were promised, because the system sort of sells these credits being the right to bring someone in. So what is it that Labor's now talking about doing to the system that it didn't do while it was in government?
Yeah, so I'll backtrack there a little bit, because I think it's worthwhile taking a little look at that story, because, you know, I remember covering immigration issues. You know, they've been stretching on, you know, I remember covering them in some stories in, you know, 2018, and that was when we had the skilled migrant pathway. And the issue there was the imbalance between the number of temporary migrants and the number of the kind of the way that the government alters the settings around the number of residency pathways. So people came to the country, were led to believe that they had a residency pathway, and then found out that they didn't, because the government of the day turned those settings down. So Labor, Labor came in and turned those settings down further effectively. But they also increased the now, this is before COVID, so the period of time when Labor was in power before COVID, they increased the level of temporary migration. So that sort of increased these issues further. Then we had that effectively when COVID happened, and even before then, there were basically these big residency queues forming, and that's when you started seeing the stories in the media about, hey, I'm a doctor out in Otaki, I think there was one, I can't get my residency. I've been waiting for 2 years because the pathway was also, the processing also slowed down over COVID, and so you had some people leaving even during the pandemic because they couldn't get proper residency pathways. And so the government brought in the residency visa to give a lot of migrants residency at once. That caused processing issues. And then during COVID, I guess that the government saw that as an opportunity to try and do some of the things they'd always wanted to do. Or said that they always wanted to do with immigration, which was to try and limit the numbers and reduce the reliance of employers on migrant labor. And so they kind of went cold turkey on it, I guess, and that provoked a bit of a backlash when those borders actually reopened, because suddenly these employers were finding they couldn't get any get any staff, and so then that brought us to this accredited employer work visa, which that was there basically to provide a good pathway and to make sure these employers are correct, ready to hire workers. But the problem was that it was entirely employer led. So what that meant was that these employers, they would prove that they had a job vacancy, they were given these job tokens. But that meant then if you're a migrant coming in, you suddenly are reliant on the employer to actually give you these tokens in order to be able to come into the country. It's no longer like you apply from overseas saying, there's a job available, or I think I have the skills that you need, you should let me into the country. Now it's about the employer. The employer or the holder of that token has a power, and that's when you started getting these agents on-selling it in these various countries. So the arguments that migrant advocates and also people in the immigration industry have been making is that the system is fundamentally flawed for that reason, because of the way that these job tokens work. And they made those complaints to the previous government. Now Labor is saying or indicating that they now want to actually go back on some policies that they had advocated for while in government, and one of the policies in favor of is decoupling the work visa from the employer, so the employer has less power. The other one is they want to see changes to the accredited employer work visa.
Okay.
Yeah.
What sort of reaction, just quickly, what sort of reaction from industry to what they're proposing?
So the industry reaction to the accredited employer work visa reforms idea is a bit unclear, but they have reacted pretty strongly to some of the recent tightening of migration, where some of the construction professions have the government is no longer going to give some of those a bit more of a pathway to residency. And that has kind of provoked a bit of a reaction from the infrastructure sector. Business NZ has said that they're supportive of the changes to wind back a little bit of migration, but places like the Employers and Manufacturers Association, they have highlighted problems and that there could be bigger bottlenecks coming through.
Okay, let's have a look at your Job Watch 2024 series, looking at layoffs in both the private and public sectors. It's interesting, isn't it? A lot of profiles sometimes on some industries and on the public sector. We keep hearing from government that more people were hired after the election than so far the job losses. And so there's a lot of discussions, a lot of politics, I guess, around the public sector stuff. Yeah. What's happening in the private sector? Because there's plenty of moves there as well. Some of the telcos, for example. example. What else?
Yeah, so we don't often pay attention to them. I mean, probably the highest profile one that we always hear about is News Hub. So we tried to put some numbers behind some of the private sector losses as well that we've seen announced. So I think from our tally of them, and this is not definitive because some of these private sector losses are just not announced at all. So I think One New Zealand has got kind of 200 net job losses. Sanatorium has got 49. So when we say net, this is often when they announce these restructures, they're saying we're going to let this many people go, but we're also opening up these many positions. So we have, I think in total, there's something like 690 that we calculated by April, by the beginning of this week, in the private sector, but, about close to 1,388 in the public sector. But those are just the publicly announced ones. So, there are, job losses and restructurings happening in all kinds of smaller businesses that you never hear about, or companies that aren't listed that you never hear about. But it is a, we have been talking to kind of a range of economists, and everybody does agree that it's going to have a hit, but I guess it depends what perspective you sort of take on it. There's some economists that are saying this is a kind of correction. If you are, we've hired too many, the labor market was too tight. We've hired too many and, both public and private, and this is sort of a correction. There's other issues like artificial intelligence and things which could be playing a role as well in some cases. I think that one concern that's been raised with the public sector is that, say, for instance, with some of these restructurings, if you take the public sector, they'll potentially all be centered in one city or one set of people, and that might make the impact more significant because it's a whole bunch of people looking for work all of a sudden.
Yeah, indeed. Very quickly, NZIER and the Helen Clark Foundation have a new report out today looking at the food and fibre exports. Of course, this is parts of this industry struggling, particularly the wool. The strong wool industry, and with profitability, what sort of insights do we get, if any, out of this report?
Yeah, well, they had an event this morning, and they invited Paul Polman, who was the former CEO of Unilever and quite a famous kind of social responsibility oriented CEO. And basically, it seems like the crux of this report is talking about how first, getting rid of two myths. One is that we are in sort of an export-heavy nation. It sort of establishes that our export intensity is lower than many other smaller OECD countries. And the second is that we are having a terrible time with productivity. And actually, what they kind of argue is that we fell behind in sort of 70s, 80s, 90s, but kind of around the 2000s, we've sort of actually grown at the same, our productivity at the same rate as many other comparable countries. But the problem is that we can't really make up the difference with that between us and others. So what they have said is, because a lot of the food and fibre sector are the majority of our goods exports, this is the place to look for in order to try and increase our export kind of capability and value. And they've kind of highlighted five areas where there's sort of some need for improvement: workforce, consumer-driven marketing, capital management, collaboration. And the interesting thing with the, they're kind of making a lot of arguments that you would have heard perhaps before, but one of them is that effectively, because we're a small market, our companies haven't necessarily had to really deal with consumer-driven marketing, which is getting to know the consumer down to the kind of granular level. Our lack of capital has kind of led to a little different attitude around risk. Because there's a lack of capital, then there's also decreasing propensity to actually take risks on it, because you don't want to lose the capital that you have access to. And management capability is saying that running these export industries is actually very complicated, and we don't have good management capability.
A lot of frustration with some of the leadership in some of the sectors in particular. So on the bright spot, and I don't know if the report went near this, there's some quite exciting potential productivity developments actually at the farm level and orchard level. I mean, guys like Fruitminders we were talking to yesterday, there's a potential for a pretty rapid productivity gain on the ground, but that's a different matter from the marketing and...
Yeah, well, actually, that is a really interesting point that you bring up, Catherine, because they actually highlight that difference. They say, actually, when you look at the the kind of food and fibre productivity, the productivity at the kind of farm level has actually been pretty good in terms of growth and efficiency. But the issue has been at the processing.
There you go. Level. Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Thank you, Dilipa Fonseca, who is with Business Desk.